Okay, so let me go ahead and introduce the two of you. I know we've got a lot of questions to ask, and I'd like to leave some time for people to ask their own questions as well. I'm sure most of you are already well acquainted with Frans Vermeulen and his wife, Linda Johnston, but let me go ahead and give a quick introduction. Frans was born in Den Helder, Holland, and graduated from Teachers Training College in 1970, and he worked as a school teacher until 1978. Even during this period of time, he began the study of homeopathy, and actually he continued the study until 1983, even though he'd been running his practice since 1979. Now, Frans started to translate homeopathic books, and this is one of the things he's very well known for. And between 1983 and 1996, he translated English and German homeopathic books, including Kent, Allen, Herring, Bericke, Borland, Tyler, Vitolkus, Whitmont, Miles Morgan, and Kohler. In 1985, he wrote Children's Types in Homeopathy, which was based on his experience as both a teacher and a homeopath. And in 1990, he was appointed the managing editor, teacher, and administrator of the School of Homeopathy in Holland. In 1992, he wrote his seminal work, Synoptic Materia Medica I, which emerged from his remedy summaries that he made for the students in Holland, Ireland, and Finland. And then he followed that up with a work which is very well known. It's a standard text which is used in most of the schools around the world, the Concordant Materia Medica, and that was published in 1994. More recently, because of his interest in small remedies, he published Synoptic Materia Medica II. That's an excellent book. There's simply information in there that you will not find in any other work. And then even more recently, his real tour de force, Prisma, which introduces data from numerous non-homeopathic sources, and it's just a wonderful compendium of very interesting, very useful information about the source of the substance. More recently, he's been working on some excellent books, a book on the bacteria and viruses called Monera, and then also, even more recently than that, another book on the fungi, and both he and his wife are in the process of publishing, I think it'll be coming out very soon, a comprehensive work on plants and plant families. So that's going to be coming out very soon. I'm personally quite excited to see that work. And aside from all the things I just mentioned, Frans is just a wonderful, lovely human being, somebody I'm proud to call a dear friend, and also an excellent educator. He has the ability to not only research and gather tremendous amounts of very interesting information, but the capacity to clearly transmit that information to other people. His wife, Linda Johnston, is a medical doctor, and she's been in practice, homeopathic practice, since 1986. She started her own medical practice in 1981 and her homeopathic training in 1986. Now, Linda has been a major contributor to the homeopathic community through writing and teaching, and from 1991 through 96, she developed and taught a two-year homeopathy curriculum in four different cities, and this was designed to train licensed medical practitioners. She's also a very well-known international teacher. Linda is the author of numerous articles for homeopathy. She's the author of the scholarly additions to homeopathic repertory from Kent's Lectures on Homeopathic Materia Medica, and a very popular book for the general public titled Everyday Miracles, Homeopathy in Action. Well, a very good book to recommend to your patients. Since her debut public lecture in 1987, Linda has made literally hundreds of radio, television appearances, in addition to print, media interviews, all designed to educate the public about homeopathy. And her most recent book, lovely work called A Child's World, was just recently published and is well worth investigating. And as I mentioned earlier, she and her husband are both co-authoring this very exciting four-volume comprehensive work on plants and plant families. Is it three or four volumes?
Four volumes
on plants and plant families. So, and Linda also is just I'm so happy to say that these two individuals have become really dear to me in my heart, and I'm so happy to spend time with them whenever we have a chance to meet the different parts of the planet. And they're so committed to homeopathy and really willing to share their knowledge and experience. Linda is a longtime practitioner and has tremendous amount to share about her cases and her practice. Now, Frans and Linda will be teaching for the California Homeopathic Medical Society at their annual conference May 14th through 15th in Redondo Beach, California at the Crown Plaza Hotel. That's May 14th through the 15th. And if you want more information about that, you can contact their website, which is www.homeopathywest.org. That's www.homeopathywest.org. Okay, so Franz and Linda, first of all, thank you so much. I know you're both very busy with your writing and your teaching and traveling and all the other good service that you do for homeopathy. I thought I would start the interview by asking a little bit about the title of your conference, which is called Precision Prescribing Through Botanical Family Perspective. This is the conference that you're going to be offering in Redondo Beach, California from May 14th through the 15th. And perhaps one or the both of you could kind of just explain a little bit to us what you mean by precision in prescribing.
Well, maybe I'll take that one since I'm kind of the clinician here, and Franz provides the information, and then it's my job as a clinician to be able to translate that into useful and usable symptoms and information when the patient walks in the room. And I think one of the things that's been so exciting about the new developments moving in the direction of looking at plant families and mineral families and animal families is that we can get much more precise in our prescribing. And, you know, in the past, for example, we had tarantula and Lachesis, and anything that resembled a snake or had snake qualities got Lachesis, and anything that was sort of spider-like got tarantula. And, there, you know, a lot of good work was done that way. But that's really prescribing kind of a generic way. And now that we understand that 50% of the symptoms of Lachesis really belong to the family of all snakes, and that 50% of Lachesis is its own, it's opened up the idea that once you see that 50% that belongs to snakes, then it's incumbent upon the practitioner to look at the other 50% and be more specific about which of the hundreds of snakes there are in the world and dozens of snakes available in homeopathy, that not everything that slithers is Lachesis. So we are taking that theme onward into plants, and in, you know, kind of riding on the coattails of our recent several year long investigation into our plant book, we've looked at 138 different plant families, and each one has symptoms that belong to the family and symptoms that belong to each member of the family. So instead of, for example, prescribing pulsatilla, it may be that it's several other species of pulsatilla or something else in the same botanical family that shares family symptoms of pulsatilla but not the individual specific symptoms. So I look at it as originally having a crayon box with 10 colors in it. Now we have a crayon box with thousands and thousands of colors. You don't just have to grab green. You can get Kelly green or olive green or yellow green or blue green or forest green or Kelly green, all these different nuances. And when that happens, it's astounding at how deeply acting and long acting and truly remarkable our prescribing and the results can be. So, Franz, maybe you can add something about the families and your, from your perspective of information gathering.
Yes. Well, let me continue the story about the pulsatilla. In the 1870s, Professor Hale from Chicago, Professor Edwin Moses Hale, believed that a pulsatilla findable, obtainable from North America, called Pulsatilla nutiliana, would just as well serve the homeopathic community in treating Pulsatilla complaints as the European Pulsatilla pratensis. So he, instead of using the European that has to be imported from Europe, the pratensis, he started using the nutiliana just for the same symptoms as the European Pulsatilla was used for until that day. And the effects were as good as those of Pulsatilla pratensis. What does that tell us? It tells us that Pulsatilla and Pulsatilla probably are very similar to each other because they're both in the same genus of plants. And for that reason, we may assume, and we have tried to figure that out in our plant book, that they are composed of similar, if not identical, chemicals. And that turned out to be the case. Professor Hale was correct in this assumption because both Pulsatillas, by the way, there are no Pulsatillas anymore now botanically. They're all anemone nowadays. So the name has changed, but wouldn't make much difference for our Materia Medica. But he was right. So Hale was very well informed about botany and about chemistry. He was actually one of the few ones that was very well informed about the chemical composition of the plants used in homeopathy. And that put a sort of idea into the mind of others that there might be something related between the symptoms caused by certain plants and the chemicals that they are composed of, the chemicals that they contain. But we have taken that nowadays also quite far, and every now and then a little bit too far, because to assume that all the members of one family by definition, because they belong to the same family, all contain similar, if not identical, chemicals would go a little bit far, because in the same family of Pulsatilla we will find aconite and Staphysagria. But they are completely differently composed. You cannot compare them with Pulsatilla. So the ultimate conclusion from that must be that there, on family level there might be certain similarities, but on precision prescribing, you cannot start there. You have to go more precisely and more accurately into the chemical composition to find out where the differences are and the possible similarities. And that's what we have done.
You know, I appreciate the fact that you mentioned Lachesis, Linda, because, I don't know if a lot of people realize that when Herring proved Lachesis, it was in 1828, and it was a better, more comprehensive proving than a lot of the subsequent proving on a lot of the snake remedies like Cortalis auritus. And so consequently, when people, would want to prescribe, they see the symptoms that would be associated with the snake, like, the sensitivity of the throat being touched or the choking sensation or forsaken feeling or any of those symptoms that are oftentimes associated with snakes. Even if it was another species of snake, they would always give Lachesis. And as you mentioned correctly, what would happen is that the rubrics would get all basically overweighted towards Lachesis, and the Materia Medica would also get overweighted towards Lachesis. And I think this is why it's so important, the work that you're doing, to actually separate these species out. So with that in mind, I wanted to specifically ask you about this whole idea of individualization in prescribing and the generic versus the specific, and how you've actually seen this to be useful in your understanding and practice of homeopathy.
Well, I can think of a case that just came to mind a couple of years ago, a woman, an elderly woman, and she had a lot of symptoms of the Solanaceae. I mean, many of our classic symptoms, the fright, the fear of the dark, the dreams of being chased and eaten, and, the usual kind of things. And she had a fear of heart attacks. And so it was very clear that I should be in that family. And when I looked at the offerings that we normally have, belladonna, stramonium, hyoscyamus, and even some capsicum and tabacum thrown in, nothing was satisfying. I felt we're in that family. But when then, this realized, well, there's lots of members that we don't know much about. What I did is I took the other symptoms of her case that did not fit the typical Solanaceae picture, and I said, okay, these must be the specific symptoms belonging to the member. And I went on internet search and Google search and reference work search and radar search, and I looked through these words, and I came up with a remedy from that family that fit her description and fit her other symptoms, even though there was nothing written about it on our Materia Medica from the non-homeopathic information, the botanical, the appearance of the plant, the life cycle of the plant, the phytochemicals and so forth, I prescribed something that I'd never used before, and couldn't find anybody else had either. And it worked brilliantly. It's been working for 3 years. And so now we have another member of that family that I got to because of the family ideas, but then I didn't stop there. I didn't say, well, I'll give stramonium if I just ignore all these other things. This kind of rigor or this kind of focus, everyone can do, but we kind of get stuck in a box of saying, but this is all that, these are all the solanaceae we have, and so I'm going to fit the patient into one of these. Instead of saying, no, let's expand and look at all the solanaceae available in the whole world, and let's find one to fit the patient. So I think that's kind of a template for what this plant book will do, and what we encourage people to do is know your family themes. But then once you feel like you've got to the right family, then look at other members and look at the non-homeopathic information, the phytochemicals, the lifestyle, the mythology, the herbal uses, and you'll find a wealth of information that can then pinpoint that exact species that we need. And then that enlarges our materia medica for the next homeopath.
Linda, I'm going to just play devil's advocate here because I know there's some practitioners who might hesitate at the idea of giving a remedy that hasn't been proven, and they would argue that, you know, the remedy must be proven first before you prescribe it. I'm curious if both you and Franz could address that particular position that some people take.
It is a well-known position and has been promoted the idea by Kent and others following him in his days. The reality is completely different. This is a theoretical assumption that remedies can only be used when they have been proven. Because if you look at the history of prescribing in homeopathy, let's say that starts about in the days of Hahnemann. Of course, it starts in the days of Hahnemann. So it has been done for now about 200 years. Then Hahnemann, sure, he prescribed only what he knew. So what he knew from his own provings or from Stapf or any of his other colleagues. But after that, when homeopathy moved into North America, much of the prescribing was done on a completely different basis, which was the reason for a lot of quarreling, etc., going on in the homeopathic community, and it has never stopped. Because that idea still exists that only prescribing can be done on what you know from provings on symptoms provided and produced by provers. The reality is that now perhaps 30% of the homeopathic materia medica has received what you may call a proving. And then still, we may argue about what is meant with the word proving, but that perhaps goes a little bit far, but to assume that proving means proving in the sense of we have learned it on our colleges and universities and schools, that's absolutely not the case. So just the realization of the reality of how the materia medica came about and the history of the materia medica, we must realize that prescribing can very well be done on non-proving symptoms or symptoms obtained in any other manner. Because who says that a symptom in the homeopathic materia medica is a proving symptom in the first place? And who says that outside of the homeopathic materia medica there are not so many, there are many more proving symptoms still left but not included in the materia medica? Who says that this is the case?
Well, another thing from my perspective is that what is a proving? A proving is the reaction of a substance on an individual. Well, when I have a patient in front of me, they are having a reaction of that energy that is in the substance on themselves. They're not doing a, quote, proving in an official way, but they are living out, they are exemplifying the energy inherent in that substance. So what better way can you have than seeing right in front of you the nature of that substance displaying itself? And so when it what's the difference between having a group of six or seven and you sit down and say, okay, tell me the nature of what you're experiencing given that substance energy is in you, and then we write down those symptoms and that formulates approving, as opposed to the patient sitting in front of me saying, here's the, basically they don't realize it, but what they're saying is, here's the nature of the symptoms I'm having given that the substance energy is inside me. Please find that substance and get it out of me. So to me, there's no difference. There's a confluence between one and the other. And the other thing is, just from the standpoint of my practice, if I only gave remedies that had, quote, official provings, there would be many, many less healthy, happy people in the world than there are now, because not only myself but many other people are taking that leap and understanding that the patient themselves is demonstrating the symptom, the patient is demonstrating the symptom, and they're asking for a substance. So that I think addresses that idea that we don't have to stick to the formalized routine. And as Franz said, 30% of the materia medica is an official proving. Are we going to chuck out the other 70%? No, they're very useful remedies if we understand how to use them.
And
thank
ultimately,
you.
What does approving prove? That's the point. Isn't it so that approving is meant with the medium of a human to indicate or to show its nature? Isn't that what approving is for? Is approving just a collection of symptoms? Well, I don't think so. I think approving is meant to bring out the essence of a particular substance, an animal or a plant or whatever. But is this the only way to learn about the nature and the essence of a substance? I guess not. Because you just have to study the substance and you will see the similarities with the proving symptoms. And if there is no proving, you can, of course, assume that the things that you see in the nature of a substance may also be part of approving if it would exist. So approving is just bringing out the nature of the substances that we use, and we couldn't do that in other manners than just the classical proving, the Hahnemannian proving, as we are used to do it in that way.
Well, thank you for that very erudite answer, both of you. I'd actually like to move on to a little bit of a different subject, which is the materia medica information itself, because we're talking about provings and the reliability of provings, only 30% being perhaps really even really reliable about that substance, and other ways of getting information about our remedies. And I know, Franz, that you've done a lot of work really looking at the original materia medica source information and really finding that there's a lot of mistakes and a lot of inaccuracies. And I thought perhaps you could, and also Linda, if you have something to say as well, but if you could talk a little bit about what you've been discovering and why perhaps this work is so important for the future of homeopathy.
We were asked how many new remedies are included in our plan book, and we made about a guess, about 500 of those. And why would we call them new remedies or new discoveries? Are they completely new, and have they recently been introduced? The answer is yes, and also no. It's also partly, because there are remedies that we have never seen in the old literature because they were put together with a remedy that we knew. So they have been more or less disguised. But the reality of the situation is that a great problem of the old materia medica is the identity of the substances used. And the knowledge in these days cannot be compared with the knowledge of our days. So what in these days was quite commonly lumped together, it was just taken as one, which is the reason why Lekesis got so many symptoms. There was hardly made any difference between snakes. There was hardly any differential diagnosis between one snake and the other. And so it was with Tarantula that Linda also mentioned, the spider. Because look at the materia medica, what does it say? It says Tarantula, nothing more. There is no species name mentioned. Look in herring, it just says tarantula. And if you read a little bit below it, you will find that he speaks both on the tarantula of the Cuban one and of the Hispanic one. For him, that was the same. Tarantula is a tarantula. If you would look at the ant, Formica, which usually goes under Rufa, but if you would look under the proving done by the colleague of Herring called Lippe, you will find that there is a black ant also included under the red ant. That was all lumped together. So the discovery of new remedies includes the dusting off of the old ones, where certainly certain remedies include actually five different ones, but they're all put under the same name. If you look under euphorbium, even in Hahnemann made these mistakes. In euphorbium, there are other euphorbias included under the name euphorbium, which is a sort of cactus from Morocco, originally euphorbium, but it will contain certain garden species of euphorbia. And so it is that we, in our plant book, we have tried to separate all these species under the correct name, and sometimes it just results in five or six or seven symptoms. That's it. But still, it needs to be separated. So the big problem in our view, and which also by separating all these species on species level, the information becomes more specific. And that ultimately, in our belief, is going to lead to more specific and accurate prescribing.
No, I think that as people want to be more precise, and more precise also means going into the deep individuality of the patient, it's incumbent upon getting the precision. I mean, I often make the analogy to identifying a family. You could say, well, take a big picture. There's 60 members. That's the Smith family. Everybody has a last name Smith, and if you said, would a Mr. Smith raise their hand? Everybody raises their hand. Well, there's a certain thing that is applicable to all the Smiths. But if you wanted to have James Smith, the son of the founder of the family, whatever, and he's the one who works at the bank, and he's the one who rides motorcycles on the weekend, and he's the one who collects antique cars, I mean, you need only to get that one guy. All the others won't do. They're not interchangeable. So there's going to be family characteristics. You could even say on a DNA level there's family characteristics. But individual characteristics means only that one. You can limit from all the thousands of people in the town down to a few dozen when you say Smith, but if you really want to go deeper and really get exactly who you want, then you have to do the precise individualization. So it's not going to be good enough to say snake, let's give this guy a snake remedy, because we go deeper into the character. We don't just prescribe superficial symptoms anymore. We want to have the exact similimum that is precisely individualistic for this one person. Then you need the exact snake or the exact solanaceae or the exact asteraceae. And that's what precision and prescribing is. I think in the days past, it wasn't so critical, and they didn't have the facilities to be more precise. Now we do, and homeopaths want them, and the results are better for our patients.
You know, it seems to me that this issue of scientific rigor and precision in terms of identifying the correct species is very important. And I'm reminded of this whole confusion around Tarantula hispanica and Tarantula cubensis, which most people believe is the same species, but one was rotted because, you know, when it got shipped over from Spain, the bottle broke. Could you share a little bit about that story, Franz or Linda?
Well, the Tarantula cubensis comes from Cuba, as the name suggests, and it was prescribed, or it was described by a man called Huar, which is misspelled in Herring, and it's called Howard, but his name is Huar. He was from French descent, and the family lived in Philadelphia, and two of the brothers went to Cuba for a while, and the other brother went back to Philadelphia, and both were medical doctors. Now, the first one describes the effects of the bite of this particular spider in a Negro man, I believe, somewhere in Cuba. And that was it. And from there, it went to the brother in Philadelphia, and who, more or less wrote that symptom up for the periodical in these days, and that's how it came about. How do you call these kind of wounds? That slough? How do you call
slough?
That? Slough. These kind of wounds. So, because it was found on Cuba, and because it seemingly was a large spider, no one actually had really seen it, except for the fact that it seemed to be a bit hairy and a bit large, and for that reason it became a tarantula. Because everything large and hairy was a tarantula in these days. But because it was observed in Cuba, it was a Tarantula cubensis, but that species doesn't even exist. There is no Tarantula cubensis. There are many hairy, big tarantula type of spiders from Cuba. There are loads of those. So what we have to do is we have to look at the effects of the bite, because we can be certain about that. That is correct. These are the effects of the bite. So it is much more likely that that was not a tarantula at all, but it was one of these fiddleback spiders that Louis Klein has introduced recently. What's the name? Loxoxalis. It is more likely that it was one of those, because they caused that kind of wounds and that kind of effects. So, from there, it became a Cuban spider, but you will see in herring that it can also be found in Texas. Yeah, Texas and Cuba is not that far away from each other, so probably it was assumed maybe they transported there, but it was found in Texas. And so from one, it became worse and worse and worse, and the story became something like that the spider being transported was rotten or something like that, and the bottle fell, or there was something left of it, and it went to Dunham, Carol Dunham in New York, but it's all nonsense. It's all nonsense. It's part of the anecdotes about the homeopathic materia medica, and this is one of those.
So really, the thing that to me stands out on this is that even up until a couple of years ago, even as an experienced homeopath for several decades, that was the myth, or that was what was told, and I never questioned it. It was told to me by reliable teachers. That was the book. It made sense for the symptoms, the suppuration and the rot and all this stuff, and I never questioned it. The brilliance that Franz brings to our materia medica is he questions everything. He will not accept anything until he investigates, he looks at the exact words, he goes to the original sources, so that, I mean, I would call him our modern-day mythbuster, because he busts those myths, and then he replaces it with what is accurate to the best of his ability, even down to going to all the original provings, the locations, the descriptions of the substance rather than what the name was called. He'll go to the substance and say, look, they call it this, but it can't be that because the description doesn't match. So one of the important things that we want to bring to homeopathy is not only precision prescribing, but precision in our data. You can't be precise in prescribing if the data is full of all kind of sloppiness. And this sloppiness is being rectified, and it's being done with the animals, and also in our plant books has been a change, so that when you read something from Franz, you know that if it's in that book, it's already been investigated to the nth degree.
Fantastic. I'm getting the sense that maybe some of the people who might be listening to this call, you know, right now or in the future when it's posted to the website, might be thinking, oh, this is very interesting, but this is kind of theoretical information, and I don't know how I might use it in my own practice. Maybe you could speak a little bit to how you actually use this type of data and the materia medica in general in the actual clinic.
Well, one example is the one I just mentioned about the Solanaceae. And the other thing that I do is, well, that's really a template for what I do, is I listen for words, symptoms, and ideas that come from families, whether it's an animal family, which we might call, you know, spider, bird, mammal. And then once I hear those kind of comments, then I go down to more specific and I look for things that come from the substance. So I'm not just completely focused on what's in our Materia Medica, but I'm looking at the Materia Medica proving symptoms, but also botanical, zoological, chemical, phytochemical, any kind of source of information. And my ear is always being attuned to that so that I don't, and when I come to a remedy, then I don't just say, well, I can give this remedy, but I might have to shove those few things that didn't fit under the carpet. I really take those things out from under the carpet and evaluate them to see, well, maybe there's something in that same grouping that would be more precise. So this is far from being theoretical. I mean, I'm a clinician, and I don't make any money by sitting and weaving fine theories. The way I earn my living is to treat patients accurately. And so the applicability of this is so profound that it's increased my results and it's increased the accuracy and therefore the depth and longevity of these remedies by being more accurate. Now, it may sound when you're just talking about it like there's a lot of theory involved, but I would encourage everybody who is a clinician to try these things out, and it will open a door in your mind and in your practice that will give you far better results.
It's a funny perception that there's anything theoretical about tracing back the sources of our Materia Medica and checking them on their correctness. It's a very funny perception that you see it that way, or that it can be seen in this way in the first place, instead of just accepting that the Materia Medica is written in stone because it was at one time started as Hahnemann, and therefore it's beyond any form of doubt. I think it's very healthy to have a good amount of doubt, a good amount of hesitation about just accepting things at face value, and that you can just here and there understand that certain things are simply not possible. It cannot be that way. In spite of that it has been written in the Materia Medica for tens of years, it cannot be that way. A tarantula, simple, or to go back to the tarantula, if that would exist as a spider genus, is not capable of causing this kind of effects. It's simply not so. There is nothing beyond the homeopathic Materia Medica, which was created by a Spanish doctor called Nunez. There is nothing beyond the words of Nunez that even gives the smallest of confirmation of the homeopathic Materia Medica of tarantula. There's really nothing. So it's either or. There is either a mistake has been made in the identity of the species, or the whole Materia Medica is just fantasy. Now, I have problem with the last, therefore I assume that the mistake lies on the identity. So the clue will be, in the end, to try and find what comes closer to the truth of the Materia Medica, or the observed effects from the spider bite as the tarantula is based upon.
You know, maybe another thing to address this issue is, you know, I was trained as a medical doctor. I approached homeopathy bringing that kind of so-called scientific view to this. But the way that I was originally trained, and it worked for many, many years, is the idea that, you know, that conventional medicine works on chemicals, and they work on, you know, the basically only the body level and pharmaceuticals in the crude substance. And homeopathy works at an energetic level. So therefore, the provings are going to give us the symptoms that are hidden in this energetic level. And there was never said as much, but there was this idea that there was no connection between the two. That homeopathy worked with energies and vital force, and allopaths worked for crude substances and so forth. But one of the things that the precision in prescribing and really delving into the correction of mistakes is the realization that there is a bridge. We're still dealing with substance in the natural world. And when you have a plant, let's say digitalis, that's used in a conventional medicine for hundreds of years, and there's certain chemicals in that foxglove plant that produces certain effects on the liver, the vision, and the heart. And it's not the case that just then when you go to approving or you go to homeopathy, you just throw that out the window, and that has no relationship to what it's going to do on the energetic level. There is a bridge. there is a bridge, and the phytochemicals, despite the fact we do not use it at the herbal level or the you know crude level, that those chemicals energetically are also going to have similar kind of effects and going to be a connection. So that it, for years we've rejected the allopathic crude world and anything that's in the herbal level, but the what's come out from the plant book and what we've seen more often than not is this: there's a bridge that when you have plants that have certain effects, certain phytochemical effects, or a spider or a snake that has a certain kind of venom, and that and the chemicals in it have certain kind of effects on certain tissues, we're going to see that represented in the proving. So we there is a bridge, and homeopaths will are best served by looking at what these crude substances do and understanding that in the homeopathic form, those tissue affinities, those organ systems, or the effects of those chemicals, they're going to be represented there. So the precision in prescribing is also to start understanding that we're not so completely apart from what the botanical substances are and doing, and they're going to be those symptoms and effects will show up in the provings and the effects and what is curable. So in the plant book, we've embraced that. We've looked at the phytochemicals and been able to make links to what the proving symptoms are. And that has enlarged our skills and our abilities and what we can see as action of these remedies.
We must never forget that Hahnemann didn't do any dynamic provings. Hahnemann used the crude substance, simple as that. He only after 1825 or somewhere there, he started making potencies the subject of the provings. Before that, he just used the diluted substances. We have actually never really studied the question why Hahnemann introduced the idea of succussion. Why did he introduce the idea of dynamization? Well, the reason why he did that was to dilute and to minimize the side effects of the crude substances that he used in the beginning. The basis of homeopathy is not changed by that because it was based on similarity. That doesn't change. But dynamic effects comes much later. It's not part of the initial idea of homeopathy that things need to be dynamized or dynamic to act. So the crude substance is still the foundation of our materia medica and of our prescribing. That's what the substance can cause is the basis of our prescribing. How it is used nowadays in high potencies is to minimize the untoward effects. That's the real reason why we do that. We have lost that a little bit because we believe that the dynamic, as Linda said, is not related any longer or has never been related to the crude substance.
That's yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. People don't realize that fragmented De Viribus and Materia Medica Pura were all done with the plants in Mother Tincture. And yeah, and
but
yeah.
I think there'd be many people who would just kind of be shocked because we're taught Hahnemann developed the dynamism and then he based then he applied the law of similars or exemplified that, but. You know, it really was a process starting with crude substance and then moving on from there.
Sure.
Now, of course, we use the dynamic quality, and that's where we hang our hat on. But we cannot lose the idea of where the roots from where we've come.
Fantastic. Linda, you've been talking a little bit about the source of the substance, and Franz, obviously you wrote that fantastic book, Prisma, which delves deeply into the source substance and the qualities of our remedies as they exist in their natural form. And I'm sure you're well aware that this is criticized, this idea, as a way to understand the nature of the substance and its medicinal properties. So I thought perhaps could you speak to this issue a little bit and how you see it useful maybe in your own practice, and do you feel there are any limitations to this method or approach?
You mean the approach of relying on source information.
Yeah, so you look at something and you say, well, it grows fast, or it's red or yellow, or you know, it's in this environment, or the qualities of the animal is this, and therefore we can determine its medicinal properties. I mean,
I don't work that way. I don't say, gee, the animal does thus and so, and therefore that's going to be the qualities that we see in the patient. I never do that. And I think that's dangerous, and it's that assumption, it's the assumption that that's how it works, or that's what we do as homeopath, that rightfully has given the most criticism. That's not how I approach it. The way I approach it is that when I'm with a patient and the patient is describing their symptoms and the peculiarities of their description or experience of their symptoms or their state matches certain peculiarities that come out as they describe certain substances in nature, then and only then would that substance be considered as their remedy. So it's not the case that someone says, well, I like dolphins and I give a dolphin. That's where the criticisms of this method come, but the fact is that's not what this method is about. This method is, I mean, that's a superficial kind of nonsense that would be kind of a resurrection of the doctrine of signatures where, you know, walnuts were used to treat head diseases because the walnut looked like the brain. I mean, that level of superficiality is not part of what the source-based information and prescribing is all about. It's so much more subtle and so much more involved. The key thing is that the patient is the source of this. The patient will, in very careful, in-depth, and judicious, non-leading investigation of the patient's own experience of their symptom, will come their state. And their state is represented in a substance. And that because the patient is in that state, it's inevitable that words and ideas and thoughts and dreams and experiences from that state are going to be evident. And they are most evident where the patient is disturbed the most, which is their chief complaint. So as a person describes their chief complaint and you get past the usual things and do what Hahnemann told us to do, he said, look for the peculiar things. So those peculiar things are going to be from the state. And, of course, the state is the substance. So when those things come out and when then the patient leads that conversation to other areas of their life, the movies, hobbies, interests, profession, incidences in their life that bother them, and you see the same words and the same kind of descriptions, and then the same words come up in connection with some substance, whether it's an animal or a plant, then you see the connection. And, you know, that's really what this is about. And it's exactly what Hahnemann tells us to do. He says in the third aphorism, you investigate what's sick in the person, and you understand what's particular in your medicinal substance, and you match those things up on well-defined principles. So how you find what's sick in a person, in other words, what's their state, you have to find it through the door of the peculiar qualities that are there. And how you find what's medicinal in substances is to find what's peculiar or distinctive about that substance. And then by these law of similars, and you can match these up, then you see. So, you know, the people who are critical of this method, usually I find they're people who don't really understand or have taken the time to investigate thoroughly. And I share with them in the criticism of a superficial rendering of this very complex approach. I find it offensive that when I hear a homeopath say, well, this patient kind of looked like a dog, so I gave them dog remedy, those kind of things make me shudder because that's what gives all homeopaths a bad name. But when you really go to the depth and follow the Organon's mandates in their entirety, then you can use this source-based information to enormously good effect.
Linda, I'm just curious. In your own practice, do you find that you use the source information in most of your cases or in a portion of your cases? Or are there some cases where you simply rely on the more, you know, objective phenomena in terms of...
Well, I would say that in the vast majority of the cases that do really, really well, the source information has supplemented or is entirely what I rely on. But I go through the method I've just described. It's not something just, you know, quick and easy. It's something very thought out and very precise. And I would say maybe 99% of the time that that's the case. It's not, you know, the results are so spectacular. And the level of confidence I can have when I have a patient where their chief complaint, the peculiar things in the chief complaint, those words and experiences and feelings and sensations show up in other areas of their life, and they also show up in their description of certain substances or, as the case, the Solanacea case I mentioned earlier, the things the patient described showed up in the botanical description of the action of the plant and the description of the plant, then I have so much confidence that I can prescribe knowing that I've gone to the end of what I need to go to and the patient will be getting better. You know, we've all had that experience of having to give a remedy reluctantly and you know that you haven't quite found the end, but it's as good as it's going to get, and you can't find anything else, and we've all had prescriptions like that, and I do not like going home from my clinic with that uneasy feeling in my chest that, you know, I know this isn't quite probably the right remedy, but it's the best I can do. I don't have that when I have confirmation on the source level.
We don't have much time left, and I wanted to ask you about your book because I'm personally very excited about it, and I know it's coming out fairly soon. So could you just tell us a little bit, Franz and Linda, about your purpose in writing this book, maybe why you think it's going to be useful to our community, and also when we can expect to receive it?
Planning is about June, July, that will be published. The ground plan of it was in the first place to clarify what there is in the homeopathic materia medica regarding plants or in the repertory programs or any other programs that we use with plants. So we have included anything and everything that is a plant, whether it has a symptom or no symptom. We have included it all. The second step was to divide and classify it all, to put it all in the right place so that there is a possibility of comparison, because there is a way of coming to small remedies through the large ones by the simple fact that they're related to each other on family level and for that reason assumingly share certain chemicals. Cannot be taken at face value, but in general, we can put it that way. So our plan was to make... to divide the plant family, the plant remedies, to categorize them, and to make the smaller ones available through the larger ones by describing the family characteristics as we see them or as we can conclude them from the material that is available and from the external material that we have introduced, source material. That's the plan.
So what we did, Franz worked on that for 5 years. He made corrections, he recategorized things, he kept things up to the current APG-3 system. And then what I did is I came along from the clinical standpoint and I added clinical correlations, clinical information, and then looked at the plant. Franz and I both did this, he from the data side and I from the data and the clinical side, then we summarize each plant family with an overriding theme, ideas, or deep qualities that belong to that plant family. And one of the things that was astounding is how we use maybe two or three dozen families out of 138, and some plant families are very close to each other in their deep understanding of their deep family themes, but the nuances are what make the difference. And so by opening up information of all these themes, of all these families, you can be more precise even in choosing the family. So every family has data about the family and then a summary of the plant family themes, some as a narrative, also as a list, and then each individual member, its individual qualities are listed. So this way, this precision in prescribing, people can come to the plant, the family idea, just like I did with Solanaceae, and then they can look down and read each individual plant and come to the, say, this is what my patient is doing or saying. These are the qualities that were outside of the family theme but were the individual, and then you can prescribe remedies you never prescribed before.
So we have taken all the remedies as Radar has them, and Radar has a lot of remedies. Some of them have a lot of symptoms, others have few symptoms, and some of them have no symptoms. We have listed all of them. So let's suppose that by repertorization you find a remedy through the repertory. Let's say Coffea, for instance, because it will have 2,000 symptoms or whatever. The idea of the book is then that you figure out in what family Coffea sits. This is the Rubiaceae, the coffee family and the China family. And that you go look in the family what more is available in that family apart from Coffea, assuming that the repertorization leads you to the family and not to the species. The same idea with the Lachesis. Lachesis repertorization leads you to the idea of snake and not by definition to a Lachesis as a species. So that's the idea of it, that the repertorization brings you to a certain choice and that you check that choice against the other family members by going through them one by one. And in the beginning, that's a lot of work. But after some time, you get a sort of experience in that. It becomes a routine that you do it that way, the differentiation inside the related members of the one that you found by repertorization, whatever other means you use. That's the plan of the book.
You know, you mentioned about, you know, you're talking mostly about the family level or maybe even going down to the lower tribe level, but obviously there are larger groupings that plants are organized by. You know, you've got the orders and divisions. And so did you guys in your research find that there were concordances at the higher levels, like, for example, like Asterales or dicot or monocot or gymnosperm, angiosperm? Did you find that there were qualities that would help you to identify those groupings as well?
In general, the larger the grouping, the more general the conclusions. So the larger, if you take the dicot, which is most of the plant kingdom is dicots, it's monocots or dicots, that's it, and they have a number of non-flowering plants, and that's a division that you can make in three. But what to conclude from that, where does it lead you, except for some very general ideas? Maybe you could say about the monocots, they have their leaves and their plant parts divided in three, which is kind of common for most of them. So what after that? So the next level down is the order, which is the collection of a number of families. And yes, here and there, there are possibilities that in an order there are related plant families. For instance, the coffee family is related to the Nyctophomica family. They sit in the same order. And that one on its own is then again related to the oleander family. These three sit in the same order. And if we would look closely at the symptomatology of these families, yes, we definitely can see links, and also we know that. Coffee is antidoted by Nyctophomica, and so on. Calcemium, normally set in the Nyctophomica, sits now in the oleander family. And so it goes on. So, but in general, the higher you get, the larger the group, the more general the conclusions are. So you need to get down as far as possible to become specific.
And from a practical standpoint, you know, clinical standpoint, the divisions at the family level really are large enough to encompass common themes, but small enough to be practical and useful. I mean, to use a trite example, I mean, back to the Smith family, how useful would it be to say, okay, I'm looking for people with two legs? You know, I mean, it doesn't limit it down to the Smiths. You know, you're going to get everybody in that town because it's not a small enough differentiator. Differentiate it from, let's say, cats and dogs, but beyond, it's not really useful enough. So the family division, we do have a few where we've linked very small families with one or two members in the next order, But for all intents and purposes, the family level is just that right division that gives useful, practical help without being too small that you're overrun with too many small divisions.
Fantastic. You know, I see that we're almost out of time, and I'd like to give people an opportunity to ask some questions as well.
Sure,
we probably
that'd be great.
We only have time for maybe one or two questions, but I did want to remind everybody that, as you can see, both Franz and Linda are very knowledgeable and have a very clear communication style, and they will be the keynote speakers at the annual conference in Redondo Beach, California. That's May 14th through the 15th. This is put on by the California Homeopathic Medical Society. And if you want more information about this conference, you can go to their website. It's www.homeopathywest.org. And also look out for their upcoming plant book. It'll be available through all the major booksellers. I'm going to go ahead and open.
Well, just one thing about the conference is what we're going to do is we're going to discuss several plant families, and we're going to demonstrate how to take data and how it shows up in the cases and how to use the data. So it's going to be a very practical information on Materia Medica, but also how to use these kind of things, the very question you ask him, and we're going to demonstrate that in our two-day conference.
Fantastic. Okay, let me open up the lines, and maybe we can get one or two questions in. Questions for either Franz or Linda? Go ahead.
They do. It's really disgusting.
Very frustrating. I was listening. It was okay a little while ago, but maybe I'll hang up and recall in.
Can people hear me?
I can.
Yeah, go ahead. Do you have a question?
No, I just want to let you know you were heard.
I have a question. I was just wondering what potency you used. This is Margaret from New York State. What potency you used for a chronic complaint generally?
Well, I don't have a set thing to say I always use this, that, and the other. The potency is determined by what the patient needs depending on the intensity of their state and how they're experiencing that state. So I determine the potency for that individual at the time of the interview. There are certain ways that patients will describe symptoms and certain way that they experience symptoms that determine it. So to me, it's just as critical a decision as the nature of which remedy I'm going to give.
Fantastic. We have time for one more question for anybody.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Boring teleconferences ever.
You have a question? Okay, well, listen, it seems like there's a lot of background noise. Listen, we're going to end the call here. We're over the hour anyway. If we can give a big North American or whoever else is on the call, thank you for Franz and Linda for joining us. I think that would be great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you too, Kim.
Thank you.
Bye,
everyone. Thank you, Franz and Linda.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.